This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. Mr. Dawkins had a bestseller on his hands in 2006, within weeks of the publication of The God Delusion. But for all of the fame and fortune that the book brought him, it doesn't seem to have inspired legions of the once faithful to cast the scales from their eyes and join him in his atheism. He did, after all, hope to convert readers, writing in his preface, "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down." What presumptuous optimism, he added. Today we're going to talk about why, while atheism is growing, so is religious fundamentalism around the world. We'll tackle the critique that Richard Dawkins is himself a fundamentalist. And in this anniversary year of the publication of Charles Darwin's Origins, why Dawkins believes that the gaps in evolution don't argue for some kind of higher power designer. Richard Dawkins has recently retired from a professorship at the University of Oxford. He's the author of a number of books, including The Selfish Gene and The God Delusion. His new book, due out in the fall, is titled The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. He speaks tonight at the University of Minnesota at Northrop at 7 o'clock, but he joins me in the studio, and it's a real pleasure to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's interesting that you didn't think it was enough to write the book, make your cogent arguments, hope that it was persuasive to some people in The God Delusion, but that you really hoped that you would convert a lot of people into atheism. What happened?
Well, I did use the phrase presumptuous optimism, which you quoted. I never really thought it would have that effect. That was the ideal. What I hoped and what I think did happen is that people who were kind of sitting on the fence were emboldened, not only by my book, but by those of Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, mm-hmm. Victor Stenger and others, to come out and speak their mind where for so long they had been inhibited from doing so.
Inhibited why?
Because in the United States, at least large parts of the United States, to be an atheist is not quite as bad as to being a raving paedophile, but there is a kind of extraordinary misconception about what an atheist is, and therefore somebody who actually is an atheist and has been for a very long time feels reluctant to say so.
Tell me why you feel the need to convert, that it isn't enough to put the argument out there.
I don't know why you say I don't feel it's enough. I mean, that's what I do. I put you're basing that on the one sentence in the preface, are you?
Well, yes. I mean,
yes.
Because, and it's a very strong statement. You're
yes.
saying, in the preface of The God Delusion,
yes.
I hope believers who read this
yes.
put this down and find themselves that they're atheists
yeah.
after they finish
what
it.
What I was really doing was putting the argument out there. In the preface, I was stating my wildest dreams hope. I mean, I didn't really think it was realistic. But I think I genuinely hadn't realized the extent to which there are people in the closet waiting to be called out, as it were. And I think that really has been a very significant effect, something that I had not anticipated.
When you talk about these people who are on the fence, do you picture them as people who maybe grew up in some kind of religious tradition?
Many of them, because many people in this country did grow up in some kind of a religious tradition. But I think many of them, too, are people who actually are too busy to think about that kind of thing and haven't really thought to themselves, what do I really believe? They'd vaguely carried on with the childhood belief that they had, whatever kind of religion it was, whether Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or whatever it was, and just hadn't given it very much thought. And one of my hopes, and I think that's realized too, is that people will be inspired to think for themselves and decide what they really think, rather than just automatically say, oh, I'm Episcopalian or I'm Lutheran or I'm Catholic. Think, no, wait a minute, am I? What do I actually think about this? And I hope that my book has done that.
I guess I again come back, though, to this original question is, why does that matter to you that you're showing people the way to atheism?
The truth matters. The truth about life, about the universe, about the cosmos, about existence, these are fascinating facts. And it's such a tragedy if people go through their whole lives believing a falsehood simply because they were taught it in childhood.
You said recently in an interview, I do think there's something Philistine about saying it doesn't matter what's true as long as you enjoy yourself. I really think that it matters what's true. Broaden that out a
exactly.
little bit.
I mean, that's just what I was trying to say. I think it matters what's true because the truth is beautiful, it's exciting, it's inspiring. There's almost nothing I can imagine more worthwhile spending your life doing than understanding the truth of why you have a life at all in the first place.
There will be people who are faithful, who are believers, who say there is nothing beautiful about the idea that the truth may be that there is no higher power. What's beautiful about that?
Well, there's a kind of stark cold beauty about it. I agree with you that it might not be as consoling as a belief that you've got an imaginary friend who looks after you and knows what you're doing and guides your every step. That, I agree, might be consoling, but if it's false, it seems to me a rather ignoble way to gain consolation through your life.
You know, your description of God as an imaginary friend who looks after you and guides your every move, I mean, there's a lot of different perceptions of what God is. Why do you choose that one?
Well, because you raised the point about comfort and consolation and the sort of warmth.
No, those are the words you use.
Yeah, I was coming back to that. What other kinds of descriptions of God are you thinking of other than an imaginary friend who looks after
you? I think
you?
There are people who believe that there is a higher power who put things in motion and isn't necessarily an imaginary friend who guides your every
okay.
move.
Okay, well, a higher power who put things in motion in the first place, that impinges very directly on the scientific worldview, which is has been my whole professional life. So my whole professional life has been in understanding the universe, understanding life, about how the way things are has come about through the unaided laws of physics and chemistry. And that, to me, is a very exciting thought. It also happens to be true, in my view. And so if that's your conception of God, then it's one that I'm equally prepared to argue against, whether or not I use the phrase imaginary friend. Mm-hmm. I use the phrase imaginary friend because the question of comfort and consolation had come up.
I guess I'm asking you, do you think it's more useful for your purposes of argument to use descriptions like that? Because in some ways they sound rather infantile and unsophisticated.
Yes, infantile and unsophisticated sums up a majority of people's religious belief, in my view.
Why?
Imaginary friend. I mean,
you're saying that's the description you choose. That's not necessarily the description that kinds of believers would apply.
Wear it. I mean, I think that there'll be many people listening for whom that exactly fits. There may be others for whom it doesn't. But an enormous number of people pray every day for something that they want. They believe that God is guiding them, is looking after them, is going to look after them after they're dead. And they get enormous comfort from this. And so that's the sense in which I use the phrase imaginary friend. There'll be other people who say, don't care about that. What I care about is that God started the universe off, planted life in it, is responsible for creation. Well, then I don't use the phrase imaginary friend for that. I'm then put on my scientist's hat and argue with them about evolution and things like that.
And would you still say, though, that description of God, the higher power that put things in motion and doesn't guide our every move, is also infantile and unsophisticated?
I wouldn't say it's infantile. I think it's unsophisticated because it very often rests upon ignorance of the scientific explanations that we now have.
I want to ask you about someone like John Polkinghorne, the physicist, the intellectual. I think you two have crossed paths.
Yes.
In some places over the course of your career. I mean, he basically says that what we know now tells us that there is no hard and fast truth, either in parts of science theory and in theology, that right now we don't have enough knowledge to know what is the truth, as you proclaim it about theology.
I agree with that. John Polkinghorne is a very distinguished physicist, quantum physicist. He's also a Church of England vicar. Now, it's one thing to say there's a lot that we don't understand, and there certainly is a lot that we don't understand, and when we do understand it, it's going to be very wonderful. And I could imagine a good case being made for a kind of deistic God, a sort of fundamental intelligence that started the universe off, that laid down the laws of physics.
Wait, you can imagine an argument for that? Are you saying you would believe that?
I can imagine an argument for that. And what I'm going on to say is that I could respect. I mean, that I could have a respectful argument about. But Dr. Polkinghorne is a Church of England vicar. That means he's committed to Jesus redeeming our sins, to doing miracles, to being raised on the third day, to being born of a virgin. That's utterly different from the sort of sophisticated God of the physicists that you've just been invoking.
One of the things that Dr. Polkinghorne has said of you and of debating with you, debating with Dawkins is hopeless because there's no give and take. He doesn't give you an inch. He just says no.
Have I not just given an inch?
When you say yes.
Have I not just given an inch?
He's not here with us, so I don't know how he'd interpret that.
But I have, haven't I? I said that a reasonable case could be made for a deistic God who started the laws of physics off, who laid down the physical constants and maybe even anticipated what might happen. That's giving an inch. I think it's a wrong argument, but I think it's a respectable argument.
Where's the evidence for that, though? I mean, when you
I'm
talk
not the
about...
One who's put, I said that was a reasonable case to be,
why,
to be made.
Why, though? Where's the evidence
I'm bending
for
over backwards. It's not up to me to provide the evidence. I think that's actually not a correct argument. But what I have said is that I think that a reasonable case could be made. And I said that specifically in order to contrast it with virgin births, raising from the dead, etc., which is infantile.
Have you come to that, or are you saying that? I mean, this sounds like you are being more flexible than you have been.
I've always been that flexible.
You have?
Yes.
You have always said in these debates, look, I can imagine a deistic higher power that set things in motion.
I do that in a spirit of bending over backwards to say this is a potentially respectable argument as opposed to the theistic argument for Jesus dying for our sins, virgin birth, water into wine. That's obvious nonsense. Any physicist should realize that.
Do you do that, though, because you feel you should to be open to debate because you have been criticized as somebody who is every bit as fundamentalist in your views as people on the other side?
I do it because I'm honestly interested in the truth. And when I hear somebody saying, as a physicist, I believe that this is one thing that physicists quite often say, the physical constants, that set of half a dozen or so numbers, constants, which physicists at present can't explain, are very, very finely tuned such that the end result of them is that evolution would eventually happen and we would eventually come into existence. That's the sort of argument that's been made by, I think, probably the physicist Paul Davies, for example. Now, that seems to me to be an adult, a grown-up argument. That's the sort of argument that you can engage with, and I think I would disagree with it, but I'm prepared to engage with that argument. I think it's an argument that one can respect. It's a sophisticated adult argument. And I say that often as a rhetorical device to contrast it with the childish argument about the imaginary friend who looks after you and saves you from death.
Do you, just back to Dr. Polkinghorne here for a minute before we go to the phones, do you, because you said you respect his work.
Well, I'm not a physicist, but I understand he's a very good physicist.
Right. And you respect his capabilities as an intellectual.
Sure, yeah.
But you're also aware that he serves as a vicar.
Yes.
For the Church of England. Does that mean that his views on religion are infantile and unsophisticated?
I can't absolutely be sure. I mean, I'm presuming that because he's a Church of England vicar, he does believe in those specifically Christian things. I know that there are other people who do. I mean, Francis Collins, the head of the American branch of the of the Human Genome Project, for example, is a highly sophisticated geneticist, molecular biologist, but he also really does believe in the details of Christian doctrine. I find that a very curious sort of split brain thing. On the one hand, you believe in evidence and you trust in evidence and you're skeptical as a scientist. On the other hand, you believe stuff that was just written down 2,000 years ago and has no authority at all.
But how about people who will say that the strongest faith is made up of a lot of doubt? Why can't you be a scientist who looks for truth and evidence to back your theory, and also be a person of faith who says, I don't think I have all the answers, and I doubt? That's part of the faith. That,
I think doubt is great. I mean, I'm a great doubter myself. But just think about what you've just said. You have just suggested, and indeed earlier you suggested as well when quoting Polkinghorne, that somebody who begins by saying, I doubt, I don't know, we don't know, we should keep an open mind. That's
right.
Great. On the other hand, they say, and I know that Jesus was raised from the dead, Jesus was born of a virgin. I mean, how confident, how arrogantly confident can you be than to say something like that? I don't say things like that. I don't say, I know something is true. I say, I doubt, I'm skeptical, I want to look at the evidence. It's the Christians who say, beyond a doubt, Jesus was born of a virgin. Jesus was raised on the third day.
Well, I think there's a spectrum, isn't there, of Christianity?
There is,
like,
but I'm talking about a fairly large majority who will say, by faith, I know that Jesus was born of a virgin. I mean, that there's overconfidence for you, if you like.
Richard Dawkins is with us in the studio today. He speaks tonight at the University of Minnesota at Northrop at 7 o'clock. Evolutionary biologist, noted atheist, as you can hear if you're listening into the conversation. And I hope you'll join us, 800-242-2828. In the metro area, 651-227-6000. Online at minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Send a Question. Get into the argument here. I'm curious to hear what you have to say. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. If you're finding a busy signal on the lines, join us online at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question to Simon in Superior, Wisconsin. Hi, Simon. You're up first.
Yes, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a real pleasure to be on the air. Yeah, I'll just preface my comments by saying I am a Christian. I do work for the Lutheran Church, but I really appreciate your guest's intellectual honesty. I think he speaks with great honesty and integrity, and frankly, I think I hear more from that from him than I do from many of the people he's debating who may also call themselves Christians.
Well, Simon, I'm curious about how you reconcile what he's saying about faith and science.
Absolutely. That's what I wanted to get to. I mean, for me, I'm sure my perspective is somewhat different than your guess. But I don't see, I don't necessarily, as I look back at the Bible, you know, the virgin birth, well, that was just, there were all kinds of people were born of a virgin, supposedly, then, you know, all kinds of people supposedly were raised from the dead. That was just the way they told stories. So I don't look at that, and many Christians clearly do take things in that literal sense. I don't. However, I look back at the tradition and see kind of great transcendent truth in there that is really, and I use truth not in some sort of literal provable, unprovable sense, but a deep truth and learning. There seems to be a power there that's a bit more than can be put into words and a bit different than just, well, I like jazz and you like blues, a bit more than just subjectivity. There seems to be something that I think my religious tradition at its best is trying to get to, and I think many other religions, I don't see it necessarily as a question of proving or disproving the existence of a divine puppeteer that either started things going or periodically intervenes to tell me which way to go.
Simon, hang on one second.
Sure.
You've given us a lot to talk about here, and I want to hear what Richard Dawkins has to say about that.
Well, obviously, if I may say so, you are one of these sophisticated Christians that I wasn't actually talking about before. What I'm curious about was why, when you say the things that you say, which obviously I can respect, why you bother to call yourself a Christian rather than saying that you believe in some kind of higher power? I mean, the Lutheran tradition that you espouse goes a lot further than just saying there is a higher power. And I should have thought that you would meet your own intellectual needs by saying, I don't know anything about this higher power. I just think that it is there and that it had something to do with starting the universe off, perhaps running the way the universe goes on. But the so-called truths that you say you get out of your Lutheran tradition, I don't understand why you bother with them, really.
To the phones to Maura in Minneapolis. Hi, Maura. You're on Mid-Morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. My name's Moira Mannion, and first, Mr. Dawkins, I want to thank you so much for your book, because I grew up, especially during the 60s, I was thrown out of school because I was an atheist and said so, and refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance, And nowadays, I have, when people confront me about my beliefs or lack of beliefs, I can point to your books and the books that were inspired because your book was published and say, if you want some education about atheism, here's a place to look. And also, when person talking about, you know, if you're an atheist, how do you see the beauty in the world? Well, right now I'm sitting here in the sunshine with two cats next to me. I'm looking at some trees and some snow. And to me, they're as equally beautiful, having not been created at some point by a deity, a being. And they're just beautiful in and of themselves.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think actually they're more beautiful because you understand, or we understand, something about how they came into existence. But I'm interested that you, when you were at school, you refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance, because am I not right that the addition of the phrase "one nation under God" is a very recent addition to the Pledge of Allegiance?
Yeah, this was about 1960. I think I believe that came in 1954 with Eisenhower.
1954.
Yeah.
So the original Pledge of Allegiance never had under
exactly.
God, and you would not have had to refuse to say it.
Well, exactly. Well, even George Washington himself said that America is no way a Christian, founded on the Christian belief system. It's not a Christian nation.
And that was commentary, I think, all the founding fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Maura, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate it. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Again, if you're getting a busy signal, join us online at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question. I want to ask you about something that I was reading that Steven Pinker, the Harvard psychologist and author, recently wrote, that the more we learn about where the world came from and even how our sense of morality evolved, the less reason there is to believe in God. Do you believe that?
Yes, I think I do. Steven Pinker is a great friend, and I enormously respect him. I think I would agree with that.
Why?
Because I think that if we're talking about morality, mm-hmm. I don't believe that any really moral person would base their morals on either the Bible or the Quran. I would certainly hope that they wouldn't. There is a flourishing discipline of moral philosophy which discusses morality from such points of view as the greatest benefit to the greatest number, something like that, which points out inconsistencies in people's moral view. If you hold a certain view on abortion, then you're being inconsistent if you hold another view on something else. And so, although I think that the scientific worldview can't actually say with any absolute certainty such and such is moral and such is not moral. That's not what science does. Nevertheless, a kind of scientific form of reasoning can point out to people that there are inconsistencies in their moral outlook.
One of the things I think he's also getting at here is that the more we learn about neuroscience, the more we're learning about how the brain has developed a sense of morality. Is that, and I think he's saying the more we're going to learn about the way the brain evolved, the less we're going to believe that our sense of morality comes from some higher power, not in our physiology.
Yeah, that's a good point. There is growing evidence, and I think maybe what he's referring to, for a kind of universal morality, mm-hmm. which transcends different religious traditions and lack of religion. Things like the golden rule, do as you would be done by, do unto others as you wish them to do unto you. These are, if not universal, extremely widespread. They happen to have been adopted by many religions, and there's increasing evidence that they are part of our brain heritage, that they're built into us in much the same way as a lust for sex is built into us by evolution.
Do you think that's true?
I think as he says, as Pinker says, there's increasing evidence that it is true, yes.
To the phones to Rita in Robbinsdale. Hi, Rita.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of comments. One of the comments is based on something that was said earlier about truth as being kind of the only beauty to embrace. And I think that discounts the beauty of mystery, that there's a great deal of mystery in the world that we don't know, we don't understand, and there's beauty in learning to walk the line between needing to know the truth and the willingness to accept mystery. And the second comment that I would make is that not all of us who are Christians, or perhaps a better term would be believers in Jesus, would be to say that, you know, we don't all believe that there was a virgin birth or that Jesus walked on water or, you know, any of those things, even necessarily a resurrection, that those things aren't required to believe in Jesus, the man, his message. And so I think that, and to still believe in God, you know, you can't just lump all believers of God into the Christian fundamentalist camp.
Yes, thank you. Your first point about mystery, I think there are two very different attitudes to mystery. A scientist, in a way, loves mystery because it's a challenge. It's something that we need to break. We have enormous mystery. I mean, science faces mystery all the time and will go on for hundreds of years facing mystery. It's a challenge. We work on the mystery. We go to work and try to understand the mystery, try to dispel it. The other attitude is to revel in mystery, to enjoy mystery, to say, oh, these things were not meant for us to understand. And that, if that's what you think, I think I would part company with you. I would regard mystery as something wonderful to be solved. Now, your other point, that not all Christians believe in all those things like virgin birth and walking on water and so on, that, of course, is true. There is a spectrum. There does come a point where you wonder why you bothered to call yourself a Christian at all. As I said to the first gentleman who phoned, why bother to call yourself a Christian? Why not just say, I'm a deist who believes in some kind of higher power? It does seem to me that if you're going to go the step further and call yourself a Christian, then you must be committed to something a bit more than just that. And most Christians that I know, even if they've given up on walking on water and water into wine, they do hold on to the resurrection as being the one thing that does define you as a Christian.
I want to come back to the idea of mystery. Are you convinced that every scientific mystery will at some point in the future be solved?
No, I'm not. And I think it's an intriguing possibility that maybe there are some mysteries that will never be solved. However, I think the right attitude to them is to say this is a challenge, and that even if we fear that some of them may never be solved, we're going to go on trying our damnedest to solve them.
So the difference, though, between that idea and the idea of a person of faith who says it's a mystery and I don't need to solve it.
Yes.
Is what you're saying here is there's a mystery, there's a truth out there somewhere about the mystery, but we may never know it. But we know there's a truth?
Well, we may never know it. It may not even be an answerable question. But I think that the right constructive attitude is to try. What I'm criticizing here, mm-hmm, is the attitude that says, I love mystery. I want there to be mystery. You're spoiling it for us by working on solving the mystery. You're a killjoy. Scientists are not killjoys. They are working on solving mysteries because they're even more wonderful when you discover the answer.
But at the bottom of that, I don't really see a huge difference. Yes, I know scientists are seeking the truth, but at some point there are scientists who would say this may be an unsolvable mystery. And don't they have to admit there may not be a truth at the bottom of that mystery?
I think the operative word is may. I don't think that's a reason to give up. I think it's still a reason to soldier on and try your hardest to solve it.
Online here from Joel in Iowa City. When you run into the unexplainable in science, where do you go? Do you think our brains are capable of understanding all things true?
Well, that's the same question as we've just been discussing. And once again, I think perhaps you could call it a matter of faith. It's not a matter of faith that we will solve everything, but it's a matter of faith that it's worth the effort, that we should try. And so far, we've done pretty well, I have to say. I mean, when you think about modern science as compared to 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, let alone back to the Greeks, we're doing pretty well as a species.
What's the greatest mystery that remains unsolved in your mind?
Human consciousness, the subjective feelings that we have, the thing that makes me, me, and you, you, and I can never really get inside you, and you can never really get inside me. That may be an insoluble mystery.
But you believe there's a truth somewhere at the bottom of that.
I believe it's worth working on.
Do you think neuroscience will help to begin to solve that, or is that not the direction to go to find
that? I think
that
is the direction to go. I think that if mysteries of that kind are ever going to be solved, it will be a combination of neuroscience and probably computer science, interestingly enough.
Why?
Well, because why computer science?
Why, yeah.
Oh, because computers are capable of feats of, we could at the moment call it kind of mimicry of mental events. It's not, probably isn't conscious, but it seems to me not unlikely that in the distant future we shall have man-made computers which are conscious in the same sense as you and I are conscious. And if that happens, that we presumably would have the solution on our hands.
So the more the more we know about the brain as well, the more we may understand about human consciousness.
Of course, yes.
To the phones to Jeff in St. Cloud. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. Your question for Richard Dawkins.
Well, first of all, I just want to say to Dr. Dawkins that I appreciate your seeking truth and how important that is for all of us to do that. My question basically is that in a book I recently read, it's called The Case for a Creator by Lee Strobel. He interviews a lot of the leading investigators and cosmologists. And one of the cosmologists proposed that a lot of people are putting science as above all and the only thing that we can learn from. But what about things such as history that cannot be repeated through scientific method? And a lot of Christians, like myself, who do believe in the resurrection, the virgin birth, things like that, are basing our beliefs on historical evidence, not just on science. And how do those relate for you?
Well, I think you've raised the question of history, the fact that things only happen once, and so in a sense it's not like science. Historical events, particular events like the Battle of Hastings, just happened once, and we have to rely upon documentary evidence for them. In the case of the resurrection, the historical evidence is extraordinarily poor, and so, I mean, if the historical evidence were good, of course it would be another matter. Even then it would be a difficult one to demonstrate. But the historical evidence is very, very poor indeed, as virtually all ancient historians agree. The problem about history sometimes arises with my own field of evolution, where it all happened in the distant past and nobody was there to see it. And we have to rely upon the clues that remain in the world today, of which there are very many. So the mere fact that history lies in the past is not a reason to say that we can't study it.
You write about the gaps in evolution, in the God delusion, in a chapter about that, and you say there's a worship of the gaps. This idea that because there are gaps in the transitions in evolution, that argues for some kind of a higher power who made the transition. Do I have that right?
Well, there is it's actually a phrase that theologians invented to criticize other theologians, the God of the gaps. The idea that if we find a place in science which science doesn't actually have the knowledge to fill in the gap, mm-hmm. then there is a tendency to say, oh, well, God must have done it.
And your answer to that is?
It wouldn't necessarily be mine. That would be the answer of the theologians who coined the phrase, the God of the gaps. You then lay yourself open to the problem that as the gaps shrink, so God shrinks until there's nowhere for him to hide. And so sophisticated theologians don't go for the God of the gaps.
But would you say to the people that believe that today, we will find the answer to what was going on in the theory of evolution in
gaps
those transitions?
Well, gaps in the fossil record are not a big mystery. I mean, fossils, there's no law that says that every animal that dies has to fossilize, and the vast majority of animals that have ever lived have never fossilized. For example, there's a whole phylum, that means a really major group of animals, the flatworms. Some of them very beautiful, some of them not, like tapeworms. Not a single flatworm fossil has ever been found. And yet this is a very, very large animal phylum. So if you were to rely upon gaps and said, oh, if there are no fossils, then these animals must have just suddenly bounced into existence. Well, obviously, even creationists don't say that. I mean, they presumably think that the flatworms go back to the day of creation, 4004 right. BC, whatever it is, and yet not a single fossil has ever been found during all the time when vertebrates were fossilizing, insects were fossilizing, snails were fossilizing, and so on. The flatworms didn't. The flatworms alone are enough to show that the mere fact that there's a gap in the fossil record proves absolutely nothing.
to the phones to Ramin in St. Paul. Hi, Ramin. Thanks for waiting.
Hello. Hello. I have a comment and a question to Richard Dawkins. I should just give you a little bit background about myself. I'm a theoretical physicist who grew up in Iran in his teenage years. And I should say I am also sick of this nonsense called religion. So I really appreciate Richard Dawkins' effort carrying this flag in the best possible way. I know that he's actually writing this book. He puts his life in danger as a person who actually grew up in Iran. My question to Richard Dawkins is that is saying atheist is kind of saying I know God doesn't exist, and is this seems to be as arrogant as the religious people who says I know God exists. So it's kind of goes against this scientific mentality that you have to
You've heard the accusation. Ramin, thank you. You've heard the accusation.
Thank you, yes. First, I'm delighted to hear those sentiments expressed from somebody from Iran. It needs a lot more courage to say them in Iran than it does here. Now, the point about being certain, about allegedly being certain that there is no God, I am not certain that there is no God. In the God delusion, I constructed a 7-point scale from one, which is somebody who absolutely knows there is a God, up to 7, somebody who absolutely knows that there is not a God. And I think I described myself as a 6.5.
You're covering all bases.
Yeah.
You realize
no,
that?
Because the gentleman is absolutely right that no scientist should say categorically, there is no anything. I mean, in the same way, you can't say there are no fairies. And you can't say there's no pink unicorn in the room. You mustn't say that because you have to doubt everything, be skeptical, be open to evidence. Now, there could be some kind of supernatural being. I bet there is a superhuman being, by the way, somewhere else in the universe, because the universe is a very big place. And so almost
really?
Certainly. Sure.
Describe the superhuman being that would be somewhere else in the universe.
How can I describe it when I don't know anything about it?
I'll bet there is. You must have some concept of what this...
The bet is a statistical bet. It's saying that the odds of life arising on a planet are such that, we can't measure them, but I suspect that they're such that, given that there are, I forget how many it is, but to use Carl Sagan's alleged phrase, billions and billions, of planets, it would be very surprising if this is the only planet in the entire universe where there's life. And I think it would also be surprising if this is the only planet in the universe where there's intelligent life. And there's no particular reason to think that our form of intelligence is the highest there is. So there could well be alien beings elsewhere in the universe that are so far ahead of us that we would treat them as gods. But that's a very different thing from saying that there was an intelligence at the start of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I'm talking about is evolved beings. And evolution is the explanation for how you can get to the sort of complexity that we recognize as intelligence.
And those alien beings would have come to be through the same process of evolution
that seems likely
to me.
The
rest of life would
have. Yes, that seems likely to me because we do have the Darwinian theory of evolution by natural selection is an astonishingly powerful force which once it gets going, it's quite very difficult for it to get going, but once it gets going, it tends to produce great complexity. And so if there is alien life elsewhere in the universe, I would bet, it's only a bet, but I would bet that it's come about by Darwinian means. No other theory has ever been suggested that works. No feasible other theory has ever been suggested to produce organized complexity.
Superhuman because these beings have had longer to evolve?
Presumably, yes, presumably. I mean, longer to evolve. I mean, after all, if we could get in a time machine and come back in 500 years' time,
mm-hmm.
We would presumably meet our descendants who were far more sophisticated in their knowledge of the universe than we are. And so I'm conjecturing that there likely are beings elsewhere in the universe that are as superior to us as we are superior to medieval peasants.
If we came back in that time machine in 500 years, would most of the mysteries be solved?
You're asking me to guess.
What do you think?
I suspect so, actually, but people have been wrong about that before, and so I'm genuinely open-minded.
So we'd know what remains right now unknowable about human consciousness, maybe?
I think it's quite likely, yes.
to the phones to Martha in Rochester. Hi, Martha.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, what, Mr. Dawkins, what do you think about the movie that came out last summer by Ben Steins? You were interviewed in it, Expelled. What did you think about that? And if you ever saw the movie in
Yes, I have seen it. I actually saw it in Minneapolis, it was rather a funny episode, which I perhaps won't go into.
Oh, no, wait a minute. You have to go into
that. Okay.
What happened?
I was taken by P.Z. Myers, who runs a very famous blog from Minnesota. And he obtained tickets to go on the internet like everybody else. And we were queuing up, and he and I and his family and a number of other people. And an usher came and recognized P.Z. Myers and threw him out, even though he was in the film and credited with grateful thanks in the film for being interviewed.
But
I also was credited, but they didn't recognize me. So I got in, and at the end, the producer, a deeply dishonest man, was standing up and taking questions, and I stood up and challenged him, why did you throw out Dr. Myers, who, after all, you thanked in the film? And it was a bit of a scene. I mean, it was. But let me get to the film itself. A deeply disreputable piece of work. P.Z. Myers and I and Eugenie Scott and various others were deceived into taking part by being told that the film was very different from what it actually was. We were never told that it was a creationist front. I never actually heard of Ben Stein before, but I met this man, and he started asking me questions. I actually told him pretty much what I've just told you about the possibility of there being highly intelligent aliens. And that the context in which I did that was that he said to me, can you conceive of any circumstances in which you could expect that life on this planet could have been intelligently designed? And I said, the only circumstances I can think of, bending over backwards to try to put the best light I possibly could on the theory of intelligent design, would be if life on this planet had been designed by a superior scientific intelligence on another planet. I didn't say I believed in that, but I said that's the only kind of intelligent design that I thought even had a prayer of a chance of being right. This was distorted in the film to say Dawkins believes in little green men, and believes that little green men created life on Earth. I mean, that's the kind of typical dishonest trick that film perpetrated.
And so when you stood up in the audience, was the producer shocked to see you there?
I can't read his mind, but I presume he was, yes.
To the phones to Kent in Mankato. Hi, Kent. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, quick comment and then a few quick questions here. I find myself that I'm potentially evolving into a deist because I believe it's possible to manipulate and package the data that goes into a religion. And then my question, I'll go through these quick and then take the answers off here. How do you explain what was there before the Big Bang? That's the theory I'm familiar with. That's one. The next one is I have an in-law that had a near-death experience, and he can, when he was clinically dead, he can tell us who was there, what was going on. I don't know how that gets explained. And then the third question is, do you believe religion allows for the control of the masses?
Yes to the third question. Get that out of the way, first of all. The first question, what came before the Big Bang? Nobody knows. I'm not a physicist. Physicists are better qualified than I am to answer it. Physicists will often say there's no such, that the question doesn't even mean anything, that time itself began in the Big Bang. Now, I don't understand what that means. Physicists will say that time itself, that is, it's a bit like saying, Stephen Hawking's used the analogy, it's a bit like saying what's north of the North Pole. It doesn't mean anything. You can go on going north, and when you hit the North Pole, you can't go any further north than that. There are physicists who will say that you can't even ask the question, what came before the Big Bang? What I would say, which seems to me to be common sense and logic, is that whatever came before the Big Bang or whatever caused the Big Bang to happen or however the Big Bang happened is a big mystery. It's one that physicists are working on constructively. And whatever else you may say about it, it's not going to be helped by postulating a divine intelligence. Because if you postulate a divine intelligence, then you've still got the problem of explaining where that came from. So you're not going to get anywhere by that means. You better follow another avenue, which is what physicists are following, and I'm afraid I can't follow them because I'm I don't have the right kind of brain.
Are you, I don't know how old you are. Would you,
67.
Would you mind telling me? Mm. Are you, even in your most private personal moments, absolutely convinced that when, you know, the day arrives and you're facing mortality, that your convictions will be as strong on that day as they are today, that there is no God? Do you leave any space for the possibility that you're wrong, and on the day you die, you find out that you're wrong?
Well, I can't prognosticate how I will feel. I mean, maybe I'll be senile and gaga. I may, you know, be converted to religion for those reasons. I certainly hope not, and I certainly intend to have a tape recorder switched on so that nobody can falsely allege that I had a deathbed
conversion.
Uh-huh. Now, as to the question of, I mean, I've already said I'm not convinced of anything. I mean, I can't say categorically.
Well, you're 6.5.
I'm 6.5
on the scale. Convinced.
I can't say categorically that there is no life after death. It seems to me to be very implausible, because everything that we understand about the way minds work suggests that they're bound up with brains, and brains don't survive death. Everything that we know suggests that brains evolved gradually over millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, getting more and more complex. And so worms have brains, but probably not consciousness. As evolution progressed, you have animals that probably have a sort of rudimentary consciousness. Maybe shrews and mice have a sort of rudimentary mm-hmm. consciousness. This all evolved by gradual degrees over hundreds of millions of years in brains, as brains got bigger and bigger. Now, that doesn't seem to me to ring plausible, to say when your brain dies, your consciousness goes on. I mean, where was it in all those evolutionary eons in the past? Doesn't ring plausible.
I hear your argument on that, and I understand your argument. I guess what I'm asking is, are you 6.5 on the scale, believing that you will be as convinced or almost as convinced as you are today in the moment when it's all going to end and you face whatever it is that comes after, if it's nothing or if it's something?
I've already said that I might be gaga. If I were condemned to death today, uh-huh. in my present, with my present mental faculties, 6.5, just about, more probably more than 6.5, 6.9.
To the phones, to Jason in Monticello. Jason, can you make it quick?
Yeah. Could you please talk about the irreducible complexity argument for designer of the universe?
All right.
The irreducible complexity argument, the phrase was coined about 10 years ago. The argument itself goes back a long, long way. It goes back to before Darwin, as a matter of fact. Darwin answered it. If there really was an irreducibly complex thing, then you want to ask two questions. Irreducibly complex means that if you take away one bit of it, the whole thing collapses like a house of cards and it won't work. So the argument is that if you have find an... And it's been said that, for example, eyes are irreducibly complex, or mm-hmm. the bacterial flagellum is irreducibly complex. One meaning of that is that if you take away one brick from the entire edifice, the whole thing collapses, and so it couldn't have evolved by gradual degrees. Now, that is false, because you can have scaffolding that is there to build the thing up. And once it's built up, you can take the scaffolding away. And so then it becomes irreducibly complex in the sense that if you remove one brick, it all collapses. But it doesn't mean that it couldn't have evolved gradually. That's the first point. Second point is that some of the alleged irreducibly complex things, such as the bacterial flagellum, it's just simply the man who suggested it didn't know enough. And modern work has shown that actually there are antecedents to the bacterial flagellum. But the third point is that most of that he simply argues by assertion. Simply he asserts that something is irreducibly complex. You can't just assert something like that without qualification, without evidence, without substantiation. Yet that's what he does. Ever since Darwin, we've been fighting off claims that this is irreducibly complex or that is irreducibly complex. And it turns out that the claims are made by people who are just ignorant.
We haven't talked about Darwin as much as I wanted to, and we're almost out of time, so we'll do that then when your next book comes out. But I do want to ask you about that in the moments that we have left. The new book is going to be called The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. Why do we need a book like that? I mean, there's
why
a lot
do we need
of,
it?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of scientific theory out there, especially in this year that we're celebrating the publication of the anniversary here of Darwin's On Origins.
40% of the American public believes that the world is only 6,000 years old.
Are they going to be persuaded by your book?
Who knows?
I mean,
but it's,
haven't you given up on those people?
I most certainly have not given up.
Why not?
Well, because there are a few dyed-in-the-wool people who will not bother to read it. But there are many, many people who haven't really thought about it very much. Come back to really the first conversation we were having. Mm-hmm. Many, many people who vaguely think, oh, didn't God do it? Oh, yeah, I seem to remember it. Doesn't it say in Genesis? Those are the people I want to reach. There are certain people whose mind you'll never change, of course, but there are plenty of people who just haven't thought about it very much. And it's very interesting. I mean, the evidence is fascinating. It's detailed, it's highly detailed, it's highly persuasive, it's massive, and it's well worth writing any number of books on it.
Is the preface going to say, if you're a creationist, I'll make you an evolutionist by the time you put this book down?
You're
or have
really
you learned your
that,
lesson?
You're really harping on that.
Well,
I don't apologize for that preface at all. It's perfectly legitimate to express your greatest hope, your wildest dream, while at the same time admitting that the practical hopes are a little bit less. The God Delusion has sold more than 1.5 million copies. It's influenced an enormous number of people. I get thanked over and over again by people saying that I have helped them to come out and say what they really think. This new book is about evolution. It's not about God, but I hope the same thing will be true of that too.
Come back and talk about it, will you?
I'd love to. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard Dawkins speaking tonight at 7:00 at Northrop Auditorium at the University of Minnesota. And again, the book that comes out in the fall, we'll talk about it then. The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. Coming up now at 10:00, we are talking about the Minnesota state budget. Some numbers crunching going on over there at the state capitol. We'll have two of the most powerful politicians in the House, in the studio here, who I suspect will have a bit of a disagreement about how to close that gap. And so that's what we're talking about today at 10. I'll be asking you for your ideas as they debate whether to raise taxes, cut taxes for businesses, and all the other ideas that are floating around out there. Tomorrow morning at 9:00, she's been called an eco-warrior and the Rosa Parks of the green jobs movement. Majora Carter is going to be in the studio. This should be a fascinating conversation. Her life story, really interesting, how she came back to her neighborhood in the South Bronx and saw the environmental degradation and basically with no experience created a green renaissance and then took that global. She'll be in the studio tomorrow morning at 9:00. I hope you'll be here too. This is Mid-Morning.
My name is James Sorensen. I'm from Minneapolis. I'm a Leadership Circle member of Minnesota Public Radio. I have been a member since 1978. I've been listening since 1966. I started to become a sustaining member in 2000, and I put the NPR on my will in 2001. It was a family situation that prodded me into thinking more deeply about how I can leave a legacy.
For information, please go to minnesotapublicradio.org/legacy.
Programming is supported by the Transport Workers Union Local 556, representing over 9,200 hardworking flight attendants at Southwest Airlines, the nation's most unionized airline. Southwest and its employees now offer new daily service in the Twin Cities.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.